The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Now, here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric Beck with you. Today we're going to do a really cool podcast. I've got a good buddy of mine that's here at my house, and we've just been discussing life, and we've wanted to do a podcast for quite some time together, and we've actually tried to get together for the last 3 or 4 months and just with our busy schedules, it's been a little difficult. But today we're going to do a two-part podcast on damage control resuscitation. We're going to really focus on the research, kind of look at all the different trials that have guided our trauma care and look at both the military and the civilian side. So really excited to have my good buddy Rakeem Francis here. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good, good. Really appreciate you taking the time and coming to the house, and I know you're taking time away from your family, and that's always hard. So we appreciate that. And for everybody that, if you don't know Rakeem, you know, I really value him as a friend, and he's a phenomenal flight nurse and flight paramedic. He does work for Air Methods Corporation as a flight paramedic at the Glasgow base in Glasgow, Kentucky. He lives in the Nashville area, but he's also an RN, and he actively works in the ICU and in different hospitals in Nashville. So what's kind of your big background? I know you've had a military career and a pre-hospital career. What have you kind of taken away from your military career?
Yeah, so I worked for 12 years on active duty. Started as an EMT basic, went to paramedic school, and started flying. I spent about 7 years flying, and probably was the catalyst in my career, the thing that propelled me to want to learn more and do more and be a bigger part of the pre-hospital and intra-hospital community. I'd say being around other medics and nurses and knowing what they know and wanting to learn more, you know, has been something that I've been really passionate about, and giving back to the community has been a big part of, you know, big part of my life's work up until this point. It's a few years ahead of me, but.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. I think that's the key thing is, obviously, the listeners of the FlightBridge Ed podcast are all like you and I, that they want to invest in their career and they want to constantly feed themselves with medical knowledge. And that's the whole basis of the podcast. So, always respect anybody that can identify, you know, we all have areas of weakness. We all need to understand that we should never stop learning. And I think that's the key thing. That's true wisdom in my book, is understanding what you don't know and then seeking that out, or seeking out mentors that can help you get to that next level of knowledge. So that's awesome. Well, I just want to thank you, you know, for your military service. And I know you'd had multiple deployments, and I know that's difficult. And, I really honor that. And for any military man or woman out there that listens to the FlightBridge Ed podcast, I know we have a lot of listeners out there. I really, really feel like, I hope we've been able to help you in your education and take care of your fellow soldiers. And, you know, if we've done that, then that's awesome. I really appreciate your support. So that's cool.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah. So we've built a friendship over the last, year and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so we've wanted to do a podcast on trauma resuscitation. And I've had this kind of on my to-do list for quite some time. And so we're going to do a two-part podcast, like I said, on damage control RSI. And we've got multiple articles that we're going to kind of cite and discuss. And I want really Rakeem's stance on how this applied to the military side. And, you know, just based on our discussions, there's a lot of things that we do on the civilian side that they discovered and they started doing on the military side a long, long time ago, well before we ever started seeing that in the civilian side. So I think that is really, really cool that really when we think about military conflict, we gain all of our knowledge in trauma resuscitation really from the military side. Is that, would you agree?
I 100% agree. You know, some of the topics that we're going to talk about, like the permissive hypotension, the strategy or the concept of permissive hypotension has been talked about since the late 90s. Amongst the military community, it's something that's been researched as far back as 20 years ago.
So I know that in my early career, we never ever looked at permissive hypotension. We always identified hypotension, and we then treated it with volume, and it was always normal saline. We didn't even carry LR. So that's amazing that it's 20 years old. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of base this on a case study. Obviously, our listeners have come accustomed to a case study, and I think that's the best way that we learn is looking at a case and trying to apply that to what we've normally seen in our clinical practice. Right? If we can apply it, then our learning curve just goes up, you know, a huge amount. So our case today is a 28-year-old, 100-kilo male that was hit by a car. You're called for a transfer to a level 1 trauma facility. Current vital signs when you walk in the door, you have a blood pressure of 88 over 62, a pulse of 130, and end-tidal CO2 of 22. And so let's kind of stop there. There's a couple things that I want to point out. We've hit on this in the past podcast, but the first thing is that end-tidal CO2 of 22. Remember from previous podcasts, the big teaching point with end-tidal CO2 is the 3 P's of end-tidal CO2. And that the three P's are confirm they even have a pulse, right? Anytime you have a systolic blood pressure that's in the 80s, really anything less than 80, and if your end-tidal is less than 25, you have a patient that is considered impending arrest based on the data. And so we definitely have an end-tidal that's less than 25. And so do we have perfusion? So do they have a pulse? And then what is our perfusion status? And we can look right over to the blood pressure and identify we have a low perfusion status. That's why our end-tidal is low. What's our acid status, right? So the 3 P's, pulse, perfusion, pH. We rule those three things out before we ever start chasing that number. Because I think if I want your elaboration on this, but we get sucked into the teaching of 35 to 45. And we forget that our body regulates our CO2 based on different things. And it's only as good as the measurement. And if our perfusion status is low, and the blood is not passing by the alveolar membrane for gas exchange, then it can't measure that CO2. So from the pre-hospital side and the military side, how is end-tidal CO2 utilized, or is it utilized?
You know, 10 years ago, if you would have mentioned end-tidal CO2 to me, it would have been a foreign concept, something that we didn't pay attention to. And even, I think even in the last 3 or 4 years, it's still something that's not paid attention to in the face of trauma. It's not given the attention that I think it deserves, and sometimes rightfully so. Looking at this set of vital signs, again, 10 years ago, the first thing I would have thought was this guy needs fluid. Today, I think I hear systolic blood pressure in the 80s, pulse in the 130s, and an SpO2 of 90%. I think, what's the radio pulse and what's his mentation?
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the first two things I think of.
And it's so funny when you think back at just our evolution of just our knowledge base and how our perspective has changed. And so I would fully agree. The other thing I want to point out is, remember, we've done a podcast on the shock index and the importance or really the utility of a shock index. And I think it just shows us that this patient has a high probability of decompensation and high probability of death, really. So anytime, remember, we have a shock index greater than 0.9, that's a bad. Right. And if you have a patient that's hypotensive and tachycardia is really the big thing. If they're tachycardic and their heart rate's greater than 120 in trauma, that's considered decompensated shock, even with a normal blood pressure. So we're also hypotensive. So this patient is in a bad state right now. And shock index, if we calculate that, remember, we're dividing our pulse rate into our systolic blood pressure. And our shock index is 1.4. So we're definitely greater than 0.9. If we look at our neuro assessment, our pupils are equal but sluggish. Patient is intubated. They say that they've got a 7.5 ET tube. We do have confirmation with end-tidal CO2. Breath sounds are absent on the left and coarse on the right. And so let's stop there and assess our airway and our mentation. What are some things based on that that you're kind of considering?
So the immediate concern that jumps out to me is the absent breath sounds on the left.
Okay. You
know, why are those breath sounds absent on the left? I'm going to want to listen and have someone else listen. Make sure what I'm hearing or what I'm not hearing is actually a true finding. And I'm a tactile assessor, so I'm going to put my hands on her chest and feel for rise and fall on both sides. Trying to rule out a pneumothorax, whether it be tension or hemo pneumothorax, based on, you know, the mechanism of injury, it's a high probability that there's possibly a tension pneumo or a hemothorax going on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously in a trauma situation like this, male hit by a car, you're always going to think of tension pneumothorax, right? That should always cross your mind. I think we should always, we're in a situation, we're in a setting that's controlled. We're not in an aircraft, so we definitely can listen, like you said. But we have definitely coarse on the right, absent on the left. So just confirm our other method of confirmation. We have end-tidal CO2, we have a waveform, but what's 3 times the tube size? And so a 7.5 times 3 is going to be, what, around 23-ish, right? 22, 23-ish. So confirm where we're at the teeth, and it may be a little deep, right? We may need to pull that back a little bit, and that may fix the issue. I think the really big thing here is we always have to use our high index of suspicion, like you said. And if you think it's a possible tension pneumo, you know, I don't think you're ever wrong in a trauma situation to decompress based on that. You know, there's other things. So what are some other ways that we can identify this? You know, patient is not on the ventilator yet, so we can't check a plateau pressure. They're in a hospital setting. What's the chest x-ray? Can you get that information? And obviously we don't have that information on this case. But I think all the points you kind of hit on are valid, and I don't think you're ever wrong in decompressing. What is the military's kind of stance on chest decompression? Are you aggressive in that way?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, needle decompression of the chest, whether for tension pneumothorax or a hemothorax, is something that is relatively simple to do. It's a relatively low risk procedure. You know, as we were talking earlier, there was a common finding amongst military communities in the causes of preventable death. The number one being uncontrolled hemorrhage. The military is really good about being able to put on tourniquets. So everyone learns how to put on a tourniquet. It's really drilled into your head. To come across a military service member that doesn't know how to put on a tourniquet, regardless of their job title, is uncommon. But the types of hemorrhage that end up hurting people or causing the loss of life are non-compressible hemorrhages, things in the axilla or the groin. Usually chest and abdomen trauma is uncommon because most people wear body armor. But in instances where there are injuries to the chest and abdomen, you know, being able to control that hemorrhage either by packing with hemostatic dressings or, you know, adjuncts like tranexamic acid are really beneficial in trying to control a hemorrhage. Tension pneumothorax was number two, and costs nothing to needle decompress. The number three reason, preventable reason why people lose life in combat is because of an inability to control an airway, whether that be because of, you know, anatomical disruptions or a lack of resources to be able to ventilate someone was the number three preventable cause of death in Iraq-Afghanistan wars.
All right. So we do have confirmation ET2 placement. I would recommend pulling that back, confirming our placement. Obviously, decompress if you feel like it's necessary. Labs, before we move on, is we have a pH. So we do have a blood gas. You have a pH of 7.21, a CO2 of 47, and a bicarb of 16. Our PO2 is 88, and we do have a base deficit of -9. So we are in a mixed disturbance, right? We have a low pH. Our CO2 is high, just a little bit, and our bicarb is actually on the acidotic side. So we definitely have a mixed disturbance on this patient. No hypoxemia. Our PO2 is normal, and we do have a base deficit of -9. We're going to elaborate on the base deficit as we move through here. We're going to kind of look at different studies and the importance of trending base deficit and how it actually predicts morbidity and mortality as we move through here. As far as their Chem 7 panel, they have a potassium of 3.6, sodium of 134, and not really worried about so much the sodium, right? We want to look at the K and make sure that our K doesn't drop any more than that. We're obviously acidotic, so that K should be higher. That's the thing that I kind of think out there. And so we have to be worried about that. And then we get into the blood product aspect of massive hemorrhage, and we can see our mag is 1.9, our calcium is 6.8. So they're both low, and that's something we're going to address as well. And then BUN and creatinine are 14 and 0.8. So when we look at this case, what we're going to do, guys, is we're going to kind of go through a systematic approach of management of a trauma patient, and we're going to focus on damage control resuscitation. We're going to hit on all these high points, and we'll do this in two parts, as I said. So to start off, when we look at this, what is our standard approach? And our standard approach is going to be our hemostatic resuscitation. And so can you kind of elaborate on kind of how would we approach that, the three high points of that hemostatic resuscitation?
So the first step in this patient with the laboratory findings and materials to control the bleeding at all costs. Control external hemorrhage. Do what you can to compress the non-compressible hemorrhage, that the difficult areas to reach, and using adjuncts like TXA to attempt to control bleeding. That's the most important number one step. If you can't control bleeding, nothing else you do is going to matter.
Okay, awesome. And then, so once we control that bleeding, we have to worry about volume, right? And then we get into permissive hypotension. So we're going to kind of hit on IV crystalloids, starting there, and then obviously early transfusion. If you have the ability to transfuse these patients with blood products, whether this is packed red blood cells, FFP, we're going to elaborate on this. We're just hitting the high points right now. And then permissive hypotension is all about not giving too much, right? We don't want to bust loose the clot. We don't need to bring their blood pressure up over a systolic really of 90. As long as we have a MAP of 65, in a non-traumatic brain injury patient, I should say, then we're fine. And then the big thing that is one of my pet peeves is keep the patient warm. I think we're terrible at this. And so I want to focus on that. And then obviously, damage control surgery is something we can't control, but we can control it in the aspect of getting them to a definitive facility, making every step through the patient care process matter. Are we wasting time on scene? Are we having our bedside times? I mean, we're going to talk about all those things. So what are our goals? What are our goals? Stopping the bleeding, obviously, is a goal, as you said. And so we talk about pressure dressings and tourniquets, and let's talk about the military application, because that's one of, I think, the expertise that you bring that I don't have that experience. When you think about controlling hemorrhage, I mean, I've had a handful of patients where I've had a massive, massive hemorrhage based on an arterial, laceration or things like that. I've only had to put a tourniquet on in 25 years, maybe four times ever. So you just don't see the volume where you have seen that over and over and over. So as far as pressure dressings, tourniquets, occlusive dressings, things like that, can you kind of elaborate on kind of the standard now and what is the best approach?
So, controlling hemorrhage is a team sport. And that's one game that the military plays really well. In 12 years as a medic in the Army, I've never had to put on a tourniquet on an initial trauma, on a trauma patient. Never. I applied my first tourniquet initially since being a civilian. And that's a testament to training in the military. Programs like Combat Lifesavers and Ranger First Responders teach non-medical personnel the things that they need to do to take care of a buddy, the guy to their left and right, even though they're not the medic. So things like putting on tourniquets, using direct pressure to control hemorrhage until a medic can get there, are truly life-saving measures that can be applied by anybody. In the situation in which I had to apply a tourniquet in the civilian world, the person that saved the young man's life was a factory worker that was next to him that took his belt off and wrapped it around the extremity and held direct pressure. that made the difference in responding to that call and the guy being alive versus not being alive.
Yeah, that's huge.
So that's the first, that's the number one takeaway from controlling bleeding. You can't teach controlling bleeding enough to, and everybody needs to know it, because you never know who's going to be the person next to you, or who's going to have to apply that hemorrhage control in that situation. It's usually not the medic. It's usually the first person there, and that's usually a bystander.
When you look at tourniquets, obviously, you know, applying tourniquets may not be as often as I would think, and I think that's tough. You know, when you've had to deal with blast injuries like that, is it one of those things where are those patients, do they, unfortunately, it's, you know, bleed out so fast where you don't have that opportunity, or is that really difficult in that situation? I mean, how can we apply those types of lessons to the civilian side, or can we?
Yeah, so it doesn't take much time for, you know, someone with a massive injury, a traumatic amputation, sure, of some sort to bleed out. But the application, I think that the application means is taking the technique or taking a resource to the site of injury. So just like we talked about with the factory worker, the right thing to do in that situation is when someone gets their arm caught in a conveyor belt of some sort, it's going to take EMS 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
5, 6, 7, 8 minutes is plenty of time for someone to bleed out. So the application is, you know, in situations or in communities where it's high risk for those types of things to happen, teaching self-aid and buddy aid is what's going to initially save someone's life or buy someone time until responders can get there. Once the responders are getting there, you know, advanced measures to control bleeding and continued assessment, maybe the first tourniquet or the measures that they used initially only slowed bleeding, didn't completely stop the bleeding. Now, you know, applying additional tourniquets or pressure dressings or using direct pressure or hemostatic agents may be applicable in that sense.
Do you guys utilize pelvic binders?
Absolutely.
So I think pelvic binders are one of those things when we think about trauma. And if you guys remember the podcast I did with Dr. Zafar Kazem from trained at Shock Trauma and is down in Delaware, started a REBOA program down in Delaware. When you think about traumatic hemorrhage in the civilian world, it's related to pelvic fractures, and it's primarily vertical shear pelvic fractures, open book, vertical shear pelvic fractures. And so that REBOA is a lifesaver. And they've actually had return of spontaneous circulation on full arrests related to a pelvic fracture, secondary massive hemorrhage. But I think that is such a cheap thing. And I really, really think that we should be prophylactically any level one trauma patient. I don't care if you elicit a pain response when you do a pelvic palpation, right? We're not going to rock the pelvis, but if you're going to push straight down on the pelvis, I don't care if you elicit a pain response. I've palpated pelvises before, and I push pretty hard, and you don't get much, and they've had a huge pelvic fracture. So you just never know. You never know how somebody's pain response is going to be. And I think every patient we drop off at a level one trauma center from a scene should have a pelvic binder in place. And I think it's a cheap thing, and I think it's something that could save a life. I know in Portland, we talked about this on the Second Shift podcast, they've actually had 5 legitimate proven saves based on what the trauma surgeon has assessed is the severity of that pelvic fracture based on prophylactic application of the pelvic binder. So, you know, what are your thoughts on pelvic binders, and is there a different method used in the military side, or can you really relate that? Do you have pelvic injuries like that?
So the volume of pelvic injuries that I saw in the military was not of interest. It wasn't prevalent. It wasn't very prevalent. But I can tell you that there's probably, it's not going to hurt anything to put a pelvic binder on somebody that you think may have a pelvic injury. It just happened to me recently where I assessed a patient who was semi-conscious, pressed down on the hips, and, you know, he kind of squirmed a little bit. I said, you know what, we're going to put a pelvic binder on him just because.
Yeah, that's good.
But there was no indication that he had a pelvic injury other than him saying that was a little uncomfortable. After getting a follow-up, it turns out that he did have a pelvic fracture. So I agree with you. There's it doesn't cost you anything to put a pelvic binder on somebody who you think or suspect may have a pelvic injury.
Yeah, true. very cheap, something you can easily do. And if you don't have a pelvic binder with you, put a sheet around them, tie it up, and you know, you just never know. Something so simple. And I think that's the phenomenal thing that I keep finding in medicine is it's always these little itty bitty things that are so simple. When you think about airway management and you think about our BVM utilization, are we utilizing it correctly? It's the small things, and it usually goes back to our BLS procedures. You know, we start out as BLS providers and we can't wait to become ALS providers, advanced providers. And then we get into the critical care side and I think we forget the BLS things, and that's our foundation. That's truly what makes the difference, really, when you think about it. So I think that's a great point. When we look at airway management, obviously hemorrhage is a big thing. We got to take care of the hemorrhage. I mean, we can't, you know, and I think that's where when you look at the quote unquote ABCs, it's not the ABCs anymore, is it?
No.
It's circulation first.
Absolutely. Right?
Circulation and then airway and then our breathing. And so airway management, damage control, RSI. Did a podcast on this. Got a lot of downloads, very popular. And I think it's the key thing is, and the big take home point on that podcast is doing all the preparatory things well. And really when you look at the 7 P's of RSI, and I kind of added an 8th one in there of making sure that, you know, you're just doing all those things really, really well. The intubation process is just one of those 7 or 8. So I think that is a key thing to remember, that our airway management is essential. How do we deal with airway management from a shock state? Low shock state. That's the key thing. And I think when we think about the shock index, right? We know these patients are hypotensive. We know these patients are very brittle, but you know, is there a recipe that's going to allow you to get this patient to a definitive facility? Because ultimately when you think about damage control resuscitation, you know, the third thing is surgery. If we can't get them there and we screw the pooch by giving the wrong medication or not resuscitating, I think that's the key thing. That's the big focus, is we're realizing that, you know, you have a patient like this that has a systolic blood pressure in the 80s and their end tidal is less than 25. This patient is in bad shape. And so if we were having to RSI this patient, I think that's the key thing, is we have to volume resuscitate this patient to a point. Get some volume on board, even if it's 500 mils of normal saline or LR. And if you're carrying blood, I know a lot of aircraft around the country are carrying blood or some type of blood product now, mm-hmm. You know, getting that started. But what do we do? You know, and I want your kind of mindset coming from the military. And if I look back on my career, you know, we've always been trained airway, airway, airway. And so we get in these situations and we get tunnel vision on airway. And we forget to treat the shock state. Right? So if we maybe slow down and we resuscitate for 5 minutes and we manage the airway with BLS procedures, in a lot of cases, our patients will do just fine with passive oxygenation with nasal cannula in combination with a non-rebreather, right? We don't need to pull the BVM out and start bagging them. We can have it ready with a PEEP valve, but it doesn't mean we have to employ that. We can have it ready and get some volume on board before we start giving these medications. So how do you kind of view that, and what's your perspective kind of, you know, being a year and a half into your civilian flight career? You know, you've got 8 years of flight experience and a lot of that's military. How does that translate over and what's your thoughts?
You know, I think the industry as a whole, whether you're military or civilian, places a lot of valor. There's a lot of focus on being able to pass the tube. That is the thing that gets you street cred, you know, which is important. Absolutely. 100% important. But I think taking a step back and balancing the resuscitation, understanding that, hemodynamic collapse in the peri-intubation period is, you know, directly, a cause of under resuscitation or inappropriate resuscitation, and using targets that are a little bit non-conventional. They're relatively new, you know, targeting the presence of a radial pulse or normal mentation or improvements in blood pressure. It kind of depends on the situation. That's a dynamic situation. You know, in the case of this young man who has a blood pressure of 88/62 and a heart rate of 130, you know, my question is, what's this guy's mental status and what's his, and does he have a radio pulse? And what are my resources available to me? Does he, if he doesn't have a radio pulse and he's semi-conscious and I begin, I have some blood and I give some blood and I get a weak radio pulse, then I know what I'm doing is working.
Yeah.
And I know that he's going to respond to blood products because he's improving immediately. So maybe give another unit of blood as I concentrate on the other P's, except for passing the tube. I prepare and pre-oxygenate my patient, maybe pre-medicate with a little bit of pain meds, probably go with some ketamine. In my experience, I think ketamine would probably work a little bit better in a setting of trauma.
Sure.
Prior to paralyzing and passing the tube.
Yeah.
That's my approach.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I think, you know, you brought up a really good point when you go back to the blood pressure and a systolic a little bit less than 90. So we're 88 over 62, pulse of 130. Again, just the presence of that tachycardia is an ominous sign and that end tidal of 22. But if we remember, the SpO2 was also at 90%. And one of the things that, that we got to remember is that SpO2 is only, again, just like the end tidal. The end tidal is the most important monitoring tool we have. And that SpO2, in my book, in my mind, is really useless unless you know and understand the big picture of SpO2. Remember, it's only a reflection of the concentration of oxygen saturated on your hemoglobin. That's all it is. So there's a lot of reasons why that saturation can change. But all of that doesn't really pale in comparison to a shock state. And a shock state is going to cause what's called SpO2 latency. It will take 2 minutes for that SpO2 to respond based on a shock state. You know, if it drops, you intubate your patient, it drops to 85%. It will take 2 minutes at least based on studies. And they, I know they teach this in the difficult airway course, to have that SpO2 reflect a true SpO2 that's current with the patient. So I think, again, we get tunnel vision. We walk in and we see that SpO2 at 90 and we think they're hypoxic. We got to, again, go back to the root cause. Slow down. You know, that's my key thing is you get in a tough call. You know, if you worked with me or flown with me, you just slow down. You know, talk about something. What are you going to do this weekend? Just kind of take your, you know, kind of diffuse the situation and then kind of slow down and identify. All right, just like you said, we've got to resuscitate first. And then give the right medications. And so I love that you talked about ketamine. Ketamine is a great medication. And I think the medication of choice in a low shock state. We did a podcast on a study that came out that really kind of painted ketamine in a bad light. But I think I've broke that down in depth, showing that there was a lot of medications given to those patients. There was only 8 patients that actually became hypotensive. But those patients actually received morphine and Versed prior to the ketamine. And so you can't blame it on the ketamine. And I think the lesson from that study that, that I took is no matter how good a medication is like ketamine, it optimizing central nervous system, right, stimulating that sympathetic response. If we don't have the catecholamines, if our patients are hemorrhaging out and we don't have the catecholamine receptors to trigger, the medication can't do its job, right? And so no matter if you gave ketamine or you gave, you know, diesel fuel, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to work. And so we have to remember, we can't always blame it on the ketamine. We can't blame it on medications. We have to understand, again, it comes back to resuscitation first and then realize some patients are just so darn sick that they're going to crash. And then rocuronium. Again, I'm not going to elaborate on the rocuronium. If you haven't heard the podcast where we discussed the studies and literature by Scott Weingard and then the traumatic brain injury study that showed a 50% mortality increase using succinylcholine in severe traumatic brain injury patients, I highly recommend you listen to that. In my opinion, there is no patient, unless I know that there's a sensitivity issue with ROC, barring a patient that has a gunshot to the face, you know, like a shotgun blast to the face, where we wouldn't want to paralyze them. We would want to do more of a conscious assisted intubation in that sense. I will never use succinylcholine on a patient again, based just on those. I think rocket running is far superior, and I'm going to manage that airway exactly the same whether I gave rock, sucks, or diesel fuel. I'm going to use the same approach. If we don't get the innovation, what are we going to do?
Continue to manage the airway.
Backup airway and manage the airway. So okay, it doesn't really matter. And then we jump into, again, our hemostatic resuscitation. When we look at crystalloid fluids, and we did a podcast where we talked about all the different types of fluids, right? We got hypotonic fluids, we've got hypertonic fluids, and we've got isotonic fluids. And we've got colloids, right? Our colloid medications. But when we think about LR versus normal saline, what is the military's stance on this? And what do they use? Because again, we can gain so much information and knowledge from their approach. But we know that those two fluids are not created the same. There's a big difference. And it may not, it may be very arbitrary when you look at just a couple liters. So I guarantee you and I sitting here right now, we could have an IV established and get 2 liters of normal saline before we start peeing. All right, we're probably a couple liters dry, right? A couple liters isn't gonna worry, but it's when we start giving 4, 5, 6 liters of normal saline, right? Because of how acidotic that fluid is and how much chloride is in that fluid, right? 155 milliequivalents of chloride. And so LR is perfect, you know? What is the military stance on that?
Yeah, so 10 years ago, it really is a testament to the progression of thinking. When the LR versus normal saline controversy, 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, when I went through basic training, 13, however long ago it was, when I went through basic training in AIT, LR was the fluid of choice. LR was it. They drilled it into your head. You knew it in your sleep that if you, for every 1,000 liters or 1,000 mLs of LR that you give, 66% of that, so 666 mLs of normal saline or lactated ringers is going to stay within the vascular system, and it's going to contribute to perfusion, to the circulating blood volume. That was the thought then. And as the years progressed, lactated ringers and normal saline kind of got lumped together, and in that crystalloid arena and into the realm of fluids that we're going to try to stay away from unless we absolutely have to, unless we have to act and we have no blood or we have no colloids, we're going to use these. If not, we're not going to. And that's kind of where we stand today in the use of crystalloids, you know, LR versus normal saline, kind of in an immaterial at this point. Let's try not to use crystalloids at all. If you have to use one, use LR.
Right.
If you have to use one, use LR. But if you don't have to use crystalloids, don't use it.
Yeah. And I don't really know if there's data that supports it. I mean, you know, if you're on scene and you give a liter of fluid, if you open that wide open, or EMS has done that prior, you know, I've flown in lots of states, and I started off in the West Coast and flew in Arizona and obviously in the South, Southeast area. And I know that EMS is done differently all over the country. And so I know here, you know, EMS a lot of times meets you at a rendezvous point, you know, an LZ away from an accident scene, and they may have initiated care. There may already be IVs established already on a long spine board. Usually their airway is not managed because around here, there's only a few agencies that really can RSI. But as far as volume goes, there's probably at least 500 mils of volume placed, hopefully. And so that kind of leads us into which fluid do you grab first, or does it matter because we're just giving a small amount?
5 years ago, in Afghanistan, so a group of highly respected trauma surgeons, with blood products at their disposal, in a trauma patient. And they're trying to guide the resuscitation. And the thinking was that they didn't want to use blood. So they use LR because the lactate is converted to bicarb in the liver. And that will contribute to the correction of the acidosis. And in doing so, they gave 7 liters of lactated ringers. You know, as I walked through the door to receive this patient and take him to another location, there is pink frothy sputum coming out of the ET tube while, you know, other providers kind of stood by waiting to transfer the patient. Because I think they lost sight of the fact that the crystalloids not contributing to the resuscitation attempt. The balance of the resuscitation is kind of thrown off a little bit. And now the patient is in a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema that they've induced by, you know, over-resuscitating with fluids. Now, mind you, that's 7 liters of fluid of crystalloids.
In a very short period of time.
Yes. So I don't think most ambulances carry 7 liters of fluid to give to a patient. So that instance may not be reproducible here in the United States, but it's possible and it's a consideration. If we combine, you know, if the ground ambulance gives 2 or 3 liters in a short period of time, and then we say we want to give another liter or two, we're close.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think the take home point I wanted to jump off what you said, I loved what you said, is, you know, you have physicians and it's really easy to get tunnel vision. I think we all are human and we can all get into that kind of tunnel vision mindset. And when you said they wanted to give LR, so the lactate converted to bicarb in the liver, and that would counterbalance the acidosis. To me, I think about that and I'm like, well, what's the underlying cause of the acidosis? It's hemorrhage. You got to replace the blood, you know, and that's the fix. But, you know, and these are highly educated people, but it's really easy to get, you know, stressed and tunnel vision. So, you know, that's not a knock. That's just one of those things we can learn from that. And I think that's probably why you brought that up, because that's something that stuck with you all these years that stuck with you.
You're 100% right. That's absolutely the first picture that comes into my mind when I think of crystalloids and trauma, is I think about the gentleman who had gotten 7 liters of lactate ringers. I think about that. And that's a conscious decision that I make to withhold crystalloids in the presence of trauma because of that specific situation. That's contributed to, you know, to the way I practice medicine now.
Well, and I think that's important. That's a really good segue into the last part of this part one of our damage control resuscitation podcast, is looking at the two really big trials. And I should say one of them that has been already completed. The other one is currently ongoing. And that's the PROPER trial with John Holcomb. And that trial is, you know, one of the things that I think every trauma center really utilizes, or I would assume that they do. And that's basically looking at transfusion of plasma, platelets, and red blood cells in a 1-to-1-to-1 versus a 1-to-1-to-2 ratio, and the mortality in patients with severe trauma. And I think this we'll put in the show notes, but I think the key thing is when you look at the conclusion, among patients with severe trauma and major bleeding, early administration of plasma, platelets, and red blood cells in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio compared to a 1-to-1-to-2 ratio did not result in significant difference in mortality at 24-hour or 30-day. And so I think the key thing is that when we look at studies, right, they have to have some type of endpoint. And that endpoint usually is a 28-to-30-day discharge. Like, are they still alive at that point? And I think a lot of time, you know, we look at things and we identify that something might be a good thing, but what's the final result? And sometimes people are so just gravely ill that it doesn't really matter. At the end, it says, even though there was an increased use of plasma and platelets transfused in a 1-to-1-to-1 group, no other safety differences were identified between the two groups. Says that more patients in the 1-to-1-to-1 group achieved hemostasis and fewer experienced death due to exsanguination by 24 hours. So I think the take home point was, is they looked at, there wasn't a huge difference, but the 1-to-1-to-1 is favorable, and just based on that. But again, does it change outcomes? I don't know. What is your view on blood administration? What does the military utilize in the field?
So at the time of the conclusion of this study, December of 2012, I was in Afghanistan, and blood was the hot topic. It was the major initiative being pushed. Two helicopters that were going to touch every trauma patient, just about every trauma patient that was going to be injured on a battlefield. So getting blood there was the answer and was the pursuit or the goal to be achieved. And I think that the take home point that you mentioned from the PROPER trial was that, you know, there was no difference in 24 hour or 30 day all cause mortality in the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio versus the 1-to-1-to-2 ratio. And of note, the difference between the two is an extra unit of packed red blood cells versus one of each. FF, sure. One packed red blood cell, one FFP, and one of platelets. But the difference was that the people who got the 1-to-1-to-1 achieved hemostasis a lot sooner. If trauma patients are going to die, they're going to die in the first 3 hours.
Yep.
Where do we make up that difference? We make up that difference in the first 3 hours pre-hospitally, from the time of injury to the time of delivery to a surgeon. If we can take blood onto the battlefield and begin the resuscitation there and decrease the time that it takes for them to get component therapy, not just packed red blood cells, but clotting factors, and assist in achieving hemostasis within the first 3 hours, that's going to increase their chances of survival. That's where the money is to be made.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, blood for me is fairly new on aircrafts. I mean, I haven't had lots of experience, but I know, you know, when you look at the Kentucky program at Air Methods, you know, they've got all the aircraft, or I should say almost all the aircraft. They're going to soon be all the aircraft in the Kentucky area for Air Methods, for example, will have blood capabilities. And, you know, we'll talk about in part two some of the just short-term study points that were identified in making the final decision to actually apply blood and put these on the aircraft and get buy-in from the blood centers and stuff like that, that I think are really groundbreaking, and I have that data. But I think when we kind of consider that, there's lots of other studies out there. And so the other study that I wanted to kind of hit on real quick is called the PROMPT. I guess there's no I. PROMPT. It's the PROMPT study. And that's the Prospective Observational Multicenter Major Trauma Transfusion Study. This was a comparative effectiveness of time-varying treatment with competing risks. What they did, the objective was to relate in-hospital mortality to early transfusion of plasma or platelets and to time-varying plasma, red blood cells, and platelets, or the ratio of red blood cells. And the conclusion was that they identified that higher plasma and platelet ratios early in resuscitation were associated with a decreased mortality in patients who received transfusion of at least 3 units of blood during the first 24 hours after admission. So this was an in-hospital study. Among survivors at 24 hours, the subsequent risk of death by day 30 was not associated with plasma or platelet ratios. So that was not effective. So I think, you know, that'll be a good segue into part two, where we'll start talking about the aspects of the trauma triad of death and the coagulopathies and all the other things that we know happen in trauma. And I think the trauma triad of death is a big one. That's what we're fighting. It's kind of fighting that ghost. You know, it's constantly trying to grab that patient. And a lot of things, I think, are clinician-induced. We cause a lot of those things. And so we'll hit on all that stuff. So until next time, on behalf of Rakeem, really appreciate you being here. This is going to be the end of part one, and we will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education. For more, visit flightbridgeed.com.